Welcome to the 416th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have such an awesome show for you this week. I'm just going to apologize in advance for the sound. I am in a hotel on the road again. And we're going to be talking about, another delay for Matter. And yet, we have a device, or many devices, that will be shipping with Matter. And we have an update on Thread. There's a lot more Thread devices out there now. Too bad it may not matter. I'm really tired. Okay, we've also got news from ADT and Google about their deal. We've got an enterprise IoT acquisition. We'll talk about what that means and why it's happening. And Amazon has opened up its Sidewalk network to developers. I've been wandering around the West Coast checking on coverage and happy to report back on what I've seen. And we've got some HomeKit news that Kevin is, I think, a little upset about. So we'll find out more about what that means.
I was cursing before the show, and I will not do that on the show. So yes.
Yes, we are kid approved.
We're clean.
We do not curse. And I've been trying out the Homey Bridge, which is a $69 hub from Europe that is quote unquote privacy conscious. And there's some really nice features for probably a certain subset of people looking for smart home hubs. We'll talk about it. We're also going to hear from our sponsor, Influx Data. And our guest this week is Chuck Sabin, who is the head of market development at the Bluetooth SIG. We are going to dive deep on electronic shelf labels and what the Bluetooth SIG is doing for the IoT. All of this and more await you. But first, a message from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Silicon Labs. Silicon Labs is a leader in secure, intelligent wireless technology, and they've launched their 2023 Tech Talk schedule. This year's Tech Talks include dedicated technology series for Matter, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and LPWANs in order to help you build the development skills needed to deliver cutting-edge IoT products. You can join Silicon Labs experts and industry leaders for these one-hour virtual trainings created for developers by developers. Tune in, ask questions, and accelerate your device development today. You can register now at scilabs.com. Okay, Kevin. One day we're not going to start the podcast with Matter delays, but today is not that day because Philips Hue, this does not surprise me, is they're going to delay their Matter update, and they're doing it because, well, other companies are kind of doing a slow roll on Matter. So Philips Hue doesn't have a date for when they're going to start updates, but they had promised to do it by the end of Q1 2003. A lot of companies were like, hey, we're going to do it in spring. And we're seeing a lot of companies maybe not do it in spring, which is what's happening here. And Philips Hue, which is owned by Signify has said that they want to get it right, which is kind of why like Amazon is holding off on supporting Thread, for example, in its Echo devices. So it's only doing Matter for like light bulbs and switches and plugs over Wi-Fi right now. Anyway.
So we have one of our listeners / readers, and I know I mentioned this either a week ago or 2 weeks ago on the show, that has been using the upgraded Philips Hue Bridge with Matter support since November. He has a developer account with Hue, and that's how he got it. And he says it's working wonderfully. I'm tempted now that it's been delayed, to get a developer account and try it. I was waiting because I'm like, why bother doing that when it's going to be happening any time now? Since it's not, I might get the developer account and see. My guess is that Philips Hue bulbs are working fine. I wonder if it's automation scenes, etc., with other devices that's not quite right.
Well, no, what's happening is Philips Hue plans when they update their hubs to Matter, it's only going to function in bridge function, which means the light bulbs themselves will not work with Matter, right? They're not going to work alone. They'll only work with the hub as a bridge. But Amazon and SmartThings, neither of them are supporting bridge devices yet.
Yes.
So even if Hue was like, oh, I did this, you wouldn't necessarily be able to use it.
You're going to be ready for when they do. And if everybody's following the standards, you shouldn't have to change anything once they do. So you're no worse off.
They may just want to wait and test it. I mean,
yeah.
This is hard because like, what if they roll it out and then Amazon in a month rolls it out and then it breaks Philips Hue? That's
again with the standard, it shouldn't happen.
I know,
but you're right.
I mean, I get it, and I think this is kind of really tough. I think there's fits and starts because everyone's kind of like, "Well, you go first,
right?"
No, I've got like a million and a half users on this. I'm not pissing off a million and a half.
Somebody's got to go.
I'm not going, but yeah, I think that's kind of where we are.
Wonderful.
Okay, you know. If this bothers you, I have a great suggestion for you at the end of the show when I talk about a new home hub.
Okay.
But it's not all bad news on the matter front. There is something that is coming out, and that is Eve Systems. So Eve was originally just a HomeKit-only company, and now with Matter, it can work everywhere. So they're really excited about it. But the existing Eve devices that were upgradable to Matter, getting them upgraded was kind of a bit of a slog.
It was, yeah, not fun at all.
But right now, and then in a couple weeks, you will be able to purchase Eve devices that are already Matter supported. So then you're just going to pull that sucker out of the box. You've got the QR code. You can open whatever hub of your choice to control it, whatever controller of your choice to control it.
Well, sort of.
Okay.
So, I mean, yes, the good news, you're right. The good news is the firmware is already upgraded on these devices. They are Matter supported. The Energy Smart Plug that I tested that I had to upgrade, you can buy it already upgraded for $40 right now. And then the Eve Motion and Eve Door and Window that are Matter certified are available on April 17th. But adding it to any controller is sticky still because of partially what you just said, smart things. Amazon, Amazon in particular, you can't add it with Amazon. You can add it with Google Home. You can't add it with HomeKit, or at least you couldn't when I tested it. There's a lot of still moving parts here.
Yeah. And so, well, we'll talk about HomeKit in a minute. So.
Correct.
There's hope, but it doesn't quite seem like the hope panned out. But as a Google user, let's just go as an Android and Google user. To originally pair my Eve plug, I had to go grab an Apple device. I had to pair it to Apple first to get it online. Then I had to update the firmware. And then from there, I could pair it to my Google Home, which is a pain in the butt, right? And some people don't have Apple devices lying around like I do, which, you know, they're pricey. I get it. So in this case, if you are an Android user using Google Home as your controller, you're going to have a great time.
Yes, that is correct. And it's interesting because I'm a HomeKit user with all iOS devices in my house, although I do have some Android devices. I could not, after upgrading the firmware, even with the Apple HomePod Mini as my hub, I could not use my iPhone to add the upgraded Eve devices to my home. I had to go get an Android phone and do it through Google Home at the time. And that was back in November, December, I forget when. However, there may be a light at the end of this tunnel that we'll get to in a little bit.
Yeah, Apple's getting better. But first, the reason this is kind of a pain in the butt is because Eve uses Thread.
Yep.
And not everybody right now is, Amazon in particular, is not yet supporting Thread devices. They will, but they aren't yet. And so that's kind of why this is a...
Yeah.
All right. But speaking of Thread... Good news on that front.
Yeah, I noticed this on LinkedIn. I don't see it on a blog post. I don't see a news release. But on LinkedIn, the Thread group this week said, big news to share. We have officially reached 200 certifications. So I don't remember how many they were at before, but now there are 200 Thread certified devices out there and probably lots more coming and in the works. I haven't seen a list. They have a list, actually. I don't know if they've updated on their website. But this is great for Thread.
Speaking of integrations, Google and ADT, they have an integration going about 2 years ago. Oh no, 3 years ago, Google invested about $450 million in ADT and said they would kind of work together to put out smart home security products. And lo and behold, today, or not today, this week is the week that they have launched their first integrated Google and ADT home security product. This is the ADT self setup. It is a package of ADT and Google Nest devices that you can buy. And add ADT monitoring to and set it up yourself. So the self-setup package and the hardware bundle costs about $220, and it has a Nest doorbell, a Google Nest doorbell, which is pretty fancy. It's got a couple sensors, and it's got a smart hub that includes a keypad. This is all very good. This is a good step for ADT because they needed to get credibly into like the DIY security market, and this is going to do that for them. It's good for Google because customers were not, like, its hardware was so expensive and people didn't love it, and they kind of messed up on their Nest Cam software, and it was just a mess. So this kind of clears the slate for Google. It puts its more compelling products like the doorbell where Google's AI and stuff can make sense. And it leaves like the basics like security sensors to ADT, which has had someone cheaply manufacture them for quite some time, right? So this feels kind of like a credible best of both worlds option, I would say.
This is like phase two of that investment, because the first part of it was to have ADT technicians install some ADT stuff, but mostly Google smart home products, right? This is now phase two, like I'm saying, self-setup. This is all DIY. And a key difference here is this ADT smart home hub, which you mentioned, you know, it's got the keypad and it's got a 24-hour battery backup, which is nice. Not everybody wants like a Google Nest display in their home. Maybe they don't even want a Google speaker. I don't know. They don't need it with this.
And things like battery backup, that's not in my, like, there are elements to a security system that the traditional device guys aren't doing. So
right.
This is compelling. And I will say this is going to compete with Amazon's Ring stuff. Ring did just announce that if you're using their security system, many of the features that people like the ability to arm it from remotely, all of that's going away unless you pay a subscription. So it's going to make actually this option, which has the ADT subscription associated with it, much more compelling, because you're going to have like professional ADT monitoring.
Right.
It'll be either $20 or $28 a month, which is a lot, but that's like the type of monitoring where if it doesn't just send you an alert to your phone, like someone will call you and be like, hey, are you still alive?
One thing about the subscription, though, it does not include, and I'm a little surprised by this, it doesn't include Nest Aware. So you need that for camera recordings. So you're not going to get those, but ADT does have a video verification where their reps can use video footage to see if your alarm was tripped by maybe your cat, for example, from a motion sensor. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't think I'd want my video footage in those hands without me having it, but whatever.
First off, I should tell you the ADT smart monitoring costs $24.99 a month. I was giving you prices for other services, my bad. But I think it's actually a really interesting offering if it opens up your video at that time for like verification, because I've talked to some first responders and one of the things they want is access to information from cameras inside the house. So like if there's a fire, they would actually like to see, is there someone still in the house? Where is the fire? Like getting remote access to that is really compelling to them. But I do agree that we should have real strict guardrails around it. And I don't think we have that yet. Cause you're right. I mean, like, again, this is where I'm like, don't put cameras where you don't want people looking at you. It's not that secure yet. Don't trust it that much. All right, let's go to the enterprise. This week, Core, a company that has been around since like 2002, it originally started as an M2M company, announced the acquisition of Twilio's IoT business. And if you're like, what? Twilio had an IoT business? It did. It actually bought a company called Electric Imp way back in the day, and it had several services that were interesting. So they had a super SIM that allowed you to put a SIM card into your device that worked around the world. It was very compelling. So you could have a global little SKU basically for all of your devices if you needed connectivity. They had the Twilio Microvisor, which was a really nice service that lets you pay a certain amount. Like it lets you anticipate your data costs over time, your cloud data costs and your connectivity data costs over time. And it brings on all of the Twilio IoT developers. And this is theoretically good news because Twilio has really sat on the IoT. They started strong with some good offerings and I was really excited. And then they just kind of stopped paying attention to it. And so I was happy to see that someone picked that up because I thought it was just going to languish there and be kind of sad. And Twilio is going to get 10 million shares of Core common stock, which is about 11.5% of Core's shares in total. So I guess technically Twilio will retain a stake in the IoT, but now it doesn't have to do anything with it. It can focus on connectivity, which is kind of what it's been doing.
It's actually been really successful there. I mean, you look at some of the customer stories on Twilio's site and those Lime scooters that you, well, used to see everywhere. I don't know if you still do.
I do.
Oh, you do? Yeah, I live in the sticks. I don't see those.
I was like, I live in a city, so yes.
Yeah, no. But Lime uses Twilio's platform to basically connect those scooters, 100 million across 30 countries within 2 years. Lime did it without having to deal with carriers or any other service providers. Twilio, I presume they use the Super SIM, and boom, it's just done.
Yeah, so Core is talking about this deal. They're like, this is going to let us become an IoT hyperscaler. And I'm going to tell you, I don't know what the heck an IoT hyperscaler is. And I actually talked to Core.
And you still don't know.
And I'm still kind of like, eh, is it really a hyperscaler? But here's Core strategy. So like I said, they've been around a long time. They were wandering around the M2M space doing connectivity for a long time. And what happened is about 5 years ago, they said, ooh, we need to do more than connectivity. We need to do all aspects of the IoT. And this is where we get the hyperscaler part, right? So they started buying companies and adding services. And just this week, they announced on their earnings, which is when they announced this acquisition of Twilio's IoT assets, that now 68% of their revenue comes from connectivity, but 32% comes from quote unquote IoT solutions. So they're going to add the Super SIM to their Omni SIM, and it's just going to be like the Mega SIM. I don't know.
Super Omni SIM.
But it's going to be a big SIM. A big SIM that does everything, right? So they're doing that. And then the Microvisor part, they're going to kind of add this whole new segment to their business, which is kind of a device builder part of the cloud, where you can actually manage your devices in the cloud and do the over-the-air updates. So they're going to have the ability to build stuff into devices. Then you're going to have the seamless connectivity no matter where. And then you're going to have the ability to manage those devices in the cloud and do over-the-air updates securely back to them and presumably with some lifecycle management, which is really important because you don't want to break your devices when you update them. So that's what I sense they mean when they're talking about hyperscaler. And then they have been creating specific industry verticals for their IoT products to help customers build stuff out. Cause it is still really hard, right? You can't just like, you got to get connectivity. You got to figure out your cloud. You got to link your connectivity in your cloud. You got to get the right data formats. I mean, it sucks. Okay. Like I've seen so many IoT platforms try to fix this. So that's what they're doing. And that's what this acquisition is about. But I will also note that Core had an IoT deal with Ericsson, which also sold off its IoT business. So Core in September said that it was going to be part of Ericsson's IoT accelerator system. They were going to work together to find deals. But Ericsson said in December that it was going to sell its IoT business to Aeris Communications, and that is a Core competitor. And so it's unclear what's happening there. My hunch is that the Ericsson deal has not closed yet. So who knows? It's all in limbo. But the point is, Core is not standing still. They're like, boop, we're going to do Twilio. We'll see what happens here. So there's some movement here.
Keep in mind, Twilio had, I guess had now, an IoT accelerator as well. So maybe that's part of this, the reason.
Yeah. I think Twilio's IoT accelerator is way more dev focused and Ericsson's is way more enterprise focused. And why you need both, the big money's in enterprise. Okay. Speaking of IoT platforms and it being super hard to connect things, Amazon is opening up its Sidewalk network. So this week it said to developers, it is time. If you would like to play on our low power wide area network, welcome. Let us give you a test kit. So I've been wandering around Seattle and then San Francisco and the Bay Area with my Amazon Sidewalk test kit. And I'm seeing, as expected, really good coverage. I mean, I live in Amazon's backyard. My Many of my neighbors work for Amazon, so coverage by my house is strong. Sidewalk Network, for those who, what is that again? Amazon announced this in 2019, and the idea was that it would create a low-power, wide-area network. So that's a network designed for sending small bits of data over a few miles. Amazon's sending about 80 kilobytes per second. That's it, of data. And it goes for about 3 miles in urban areas. And what it does is you can send things over this LoRa network. It's proprietary LoRa, so not generic LoRa that will work with other LoRaWAN networks.
Of course not.
But it uses your Wi-Fi access as backhaul to the internet. So you've got in your Amazon Echo devices and soon in some Ring devices, a radio that will function for LoRa and a radio that, you know, your Wi-Fi radio that connects it. And so Amazon, when they talk about it, they're talking about it mostly from a point of view like, oh, it helps provide a little more reliability. So if someone's power goes out, you know, their connected lock or sensors will still work and send data using the LoRa network to other houses that might have power nearby, for example.
Right. So if hopefully those other houses have Amazon Echo devices that support Sidewalk, because that's how your devices will get on the internet.
Yes. And, you know, I will say, in my testing, I am seeing really solid signal strength in proper areas, in major areas. It does peter out a little bit as you get farther from urban cities. And Amazon says it covers up to 90% of the U.S. population. But if you're in that 10% that live in the middle of freaking nowhere, there is no coverage.
Yeah, I'm curious, since I do live in the sticks. And by sticks, I mean like 30 minutes north of Philadelphia, in between Philadelphia and Allentown in Pennsylvania, where it's still pretty rural. I'm curious what the coverage will be like here. If the signal strength or the distance the signal can travel is accurate, it's probably going to be okay, I'm thinking, because there's maybe, you know, my next door neighbors don't have Echo devices, but I'm sure within a half mile, there's got to be a few, you know?
Yeah, well, and, you know, don't you have an Amazon device? You could just turn it on.
Well, I could do that too, yes. But for people who don't, you know, I'm just curious about how robust the network is in those non-urban areas, right?
Yeah, well, I can send you the thing and you can see. Aha.
Aha.
Aha. So yeah, and I would be remiss. You know, Amazon has said they will only use up to 500 megabytes of your Wi-Fi. So that's half a gig of Wi-Fi if you're on a data plan that's relevant to you to send Sidewalk traffic. It is secure. Amazon can't see what the devices are sending. And it's secure from an attack perspective. It is using very secure algorithms and it's designed so people can't do man in the middle attacks. But people are still concerned, and I think it's a legitimate concern to be like, hey, do I really want to share my Wi-Fi with a multi-billion dollar company that is kind of not kind to its workers?
Or yeah. But if you can get past that, it's probably worth mentioning that this is an ideal potential solution for the calls that we get for people who are like, I need to put like a gate lock device on my gate at my driveway, but the Wi-Fi doesn't reach. I don't want to have a cellular bill for this thing. You know, what can I do? Well, this is what you can do, and it won't cost you for the connectivity. You'll just have to pay for a compatible device.
And Amazon is not charging developers for the connectivity on the Sidewalk network, but the Sidewalk network traffic will only go into AWS IoT. So this is another one of Amazon's really excellent funnels into AWS. And it's worth noting that because we hate lock-in, we hate this sort of thing, but at the same time, it is still so hard to connect IoT devices, see the core conversation just a minute ago. And this does it all for you. Amazon has partnerships with several chip companies, and it's going to be like a developer will be able to put a certified board in their device and then access their AWS account, point that device to that account, and then go. You don't have to worry about setting up like a LoRa server or any of this backend stuff. So, yeah, it's easy. What isn't easy is what's happening over with HomeKit. What is happening over with HomeKit?
Well, first I'll say I want to bring up an application that I mentioned, I don't know how many shows ago, called Home Plus. It's a free app for iOS and basically replaces your regular home app in a sense. You don't even need to use the home app because it's kind of like Apple's home app on steroids. And it just got better because now you can do much more fine tuning in your settings. You could always back up and restore your HomeKit configuration, which I might need. We'll get to in a minute. You can now mass edit scenes and automations, and it's just easier to add devices and configure them in Home Plus. So I'm surprised Apple doesn't just buy this app, the people behind this app. So, but whatever. It's a free app. There is a $15 fee to unlock all the features. So it's kind of like a limited version for free. And trust me, having tried it, if you try the free version, you're a HomeKit user, you'll probably want to spend the $15. It would be my guess. It's worth it, in my opinion. So the features that Home Plus brings with HomeKit backups and restoration might come in handy for me because we've been talking about the new Apple HomeKit architecture that came with iOS 16.1, which me being, well, I just, you know, can't not download an update quickly. I updated my phones to 16.1 back then and got the new architecture, and then Apple pulled the update because of problems the architecture brought. And I've had nothing but problems since then. And we've said, hey, and might be coming in 16.2. No, how about 16.3? No. This week it is here in 16.4. So iOS 16.4 brings the new HomeKit architecture, if you didn't already have it. So when I upgraded my phone, I didn't get anything new in that regard. I got some other features that aren't really relevant to the show, such as 21 new emojis and such. Yeah, but my wife upgraded her phone. I as soon as I saw this is supposed to fix the HomeKit architecture problem, I'm like, oh, you need to upgrade your phone. I'm going to upgrade my two iPads. I'm going to double check the HomePod and let's make sure everything's 16.4 and let's see if HomeKit's working now. And what happened was my wife cannot connect to our shared HomeKit home now. I am not the only person that's having this problem. This is one of the problems that we've been having. I would invite her, and she couldn't accept the invitation, or she never got the invitation. Those issues are fixed. She gets the invitation, and she accepts it, but she ends up with a blank new home, not the home that I have invited her to. Again, I'm not the only person with this problem. However, there are other people who are not having this problem, so I don't know what the issue is. I'm not going to tell you not to do the upgrade. I think that's a personal decision. I think if you did not have the HomeKit architecture upgrade from 16.1 and you get it now, you'll probably be okay. I think this is a residual result of my having it early. But it's out there and it's causing me nothing but trouble because my wife had to text me from the bed last night while I was downstairs saying, could you lower the light in the bedroom to a smidge? I can't do it.
You need a HomePod up there so she could at least talk to it and do it as last.
Yeah, there's one in my office. Honestly, I don't want to say this too loud because she's in the next room over, but she could have used her Apple Watch. No, she couldn't because I don't think she's connected to the home. You're right. Button would work. HomePod probably would work. I don't know. Kevin is frustrated. That's all I'm going to say. And we'll see what happens.
It is a real blow because Apple's been so good for users. So this has gone on for months. Ugh.
Yeah, yeah. This is also to bring all the Matter goodies into HomeKit, by the way. So that's why I jumped on it with 16.1 because I figured I could test it and we could discuss it here, but that didn't happen.
Well, we're discussing it. We're just discussing something different. Okay, well, let me tell you about a different device that probably won't help you because I know you're not a fan of hubs, but I'm going to tell you about it anyway. So at home, I have been thinking it was Athome, and then I looked at it. I was like, I think they were trying to say at home. It's a European company. They make a device called the Homey Bridge and the Homey Pro. The Homey Bridge is what I've been testing. It's just now this week for sale for $69 here in the US. What it is a very simple hub. Homey's whole ethos is around privacy, and it's around respecting the limitations of the connected device business model, which means you're going to have to pay a subscription to keep something connected for the long term. So with that in mind, the Homey Bridge, $69, will connect you. It's a Z-Wave, Zigbee, Bluetooth, IR Blaster, and Wi-Fi. All this in this lovely little black hub. It's got some lovely little rainbow lights happening on it. Very, very fancy. But it doesn't have a lot of computing power, and the bridge is designed to really do a lot of cloud-to-cloud connections. So what you would do there is you would connect many of your smart home devices to it. You can connect up to 5 devices, and then after that, you've got to pay a $2.99 a month subscription fee, just so y'all know. But they're doing this because they don't want to sell your data. They're like, the CEO of the company is like, look, if I don't charge you the subscription fee, I have to make money somehow on this, and then I have to sell your data. So privacy does cost money. It costs money to keep a cloud connection going. It does.
Yes.
I can't argue with that. So knowing that going in, and I think they're very upfront about it, I connected, because this is a European company, there are lots of European companies already integrated. And things like Philips Hue are in there. IKEA gear is in there. Sonos is in there. I know they're not. Fibaro, Netatmo.
Aquara,
Bosch. Aquara is a Xiaomi company, I believe. Isn't it?
I thought they were French, but I don't know.
It also connects with some U.S. brands like Ecobee and Yale, and they're working all the time on more. They don't have Lutron yet, which made me so sad. Lutron, get on this. I love it. My favorite thing about this is it works with Somfy. And y'all know I have Somfy shades. But the Somfy radio protocol is proprietary, and Somfy sells a very expensive bridge. So expensive. I don't want to spend that much money to automate my Somfy shades. It's not worth it to me. But for $69, I can actually do it with this using the IR feature. It just has to be in the same room. So if you have Somfy shades all over your house, you're going to need multiple of these, just so you know. And there are more apps. And so what they're doing with the Pro, which isn't available here yet for general sale, that is a $399 device with a massively powered computer inside the hub that is going to locally handle as much as possible. And it will also connect to your bridge. So if you buy the bridge and you like it, you could actually graduate to the Pro and then just use the bridge as an IR blaster, which is maybe what I would do. Because I really like this. You can download apps from the Homey store that also support other integrations like Flick buttons or Tesla. And the difference between these, the access to these integrations comes about because the Pro assumes that you know what you're doing and you're willing to kind of play with apps that are built by the community. So the community can build these apps, put them up for Pro users, and then Pro users can download them knowing that maybe the guys doing that particular app may one day get sick of supporting it and kill it, right? They didn't want to do that with the Bridge users because they felt that those users are probably going to be less sophisticated. So I'm really excited about it. In addition to like the basic rules engines that you can do, they also let you set up pretty complicated flows. And flows are exactly what it sounds like. It's when this happens, if it's this time, and this other thing is on, then do this. And those work really well. The one caveat I will say, if you play with this system, the software is not quite there yet. The user interface or the user interactions are not great. Like my example is everything is a long press. Once you get used to that, you're like, oh, okay, I'm just going to long press this. But I had been tapping away for like forever. Like, why is nothing working? The other thing is when you set up devices, it doesn't give you an option to put them into rooms. So you're going to have to set up your device, get it online, and then go back and tweak it, which is a little frustrating. But overall, very nice. I like it. $69. Control. I mean, it's a nice Zigbee bridge. Eventually, Homey will support Matter. It's going to come to the Pro before it comes to the bridge. So it doesn't support Matter today, but that's kind of where that is. So check it out if you're into it. Okay, that concludes this segment of the show. But now let's go to the segment of the show where we hear from you, our callers. That's right. It's time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline, which is sponsored by Very. An end-to-end IoT engineering and design firm. Partner with Very to work through complexity and deliver business value rapidly. Learn more at verytechnology.com. And you could reach us and ask us questions at 512-623-7424. Let's hear today's question.
Hi, Stacey and Kevin. I was curious on what you guys thought of the Shelly devices. Have you used them? What use cases can you use for them? Thank you. Bye.
Well, this ought to be an easy one for you because you've used several of their products.
Yeah, so I've used their modules, I don't know if it's the P1. They have a bunch of modules. And then I've also used their Wi-Fi sensor. And so I love Shelly devices. AlterCo is a company, a European company. They make quality products. The modules are modules that you wire into your electrical outlets, and they will turn your electrical outlets smarter. And they have a lot of variations on them depending on the power draw. Do you have a neutral wire or not? Do you want to monitor energy? There's a lot of things to consider. And I'll ask the Shelly guys to come on the podcast. I think it would actually be a good show. And they have their Shelly software, and then they also have integrations with lots of other popular companies and organizations. But the Shelly software is actually very powerful. It kind of reminds me of HomeKit, believe it or not. It's just well done. So I would say to you, do not feel bad about investing in the Shelly products because they're high quality. Their forums are great. The people who are building this know a lot about what they're doing, and they know a lot about how electricity works.
Yeah, which is good.
Which I think is important. So yes, if I were starting from scratch, I might wire Shelly modules into all of my outlets and switches just because it would give me so much power. Not literally power, but
Control. How about that?
Control. Thank you. And it works, and they work with Amazon, Google, and SmartThings. And yeah, I don't know what to tell you. If you like some Shelly stuff, yes, buy it. It's good.
Yeah, we talked about Home Assistant a few weeks back and their new energy monitoring support in the software. And one of the two options that I'd like to look at a little further, one of them comes from Shelly. They're Shelly EMs and then the clamps that go around in your breaker box to track everything. That can be done in Home Assistant. So yeah, maybe we'll spend some money, get a couple of these, and we can tell you a little bit more about that product from Shelly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you want to.
And by spend money, I mean Stacey buys.
Yeah, I got that.
Okay.
Yes, I'm aware. But yeah, good products. I'll see about getting them on the show to talk about it some more because, again, I like them a lot. They also have light bulbs and things like that. But the big things are the Shelly power modules, and they've got variations. Their Wi-Fi, all of their stuff is Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. And yeah, good stuff. All right, that's that. And remember, if you would like to give us a call and ask us a question, we're available at 512-623-7424. That concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest. Our guest this week is Chuck Sabin, who is the head of market development for the Bluetooth SIG. We're going to be talking about electronic shelf labels and what's next for Bluetooth. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Influx Data. Hey, everyone. We are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is InfluxDB, and I have Brian Mullen, the Chief Marketing Officer at InfluxDB, here to talk to us about the database and customers, including Tesla. Brian, what is InfluxDB?
InfluxDB is a platform for developers to handle time series data at scale. To give you an idea what time series data is, it's really just data that is stamped in time in some way. And that could be hours or minutes or seconds or even nanoseconds. Handling this type of data is pretty difficult and time consuming, and InfluxDB makes it simple and fast. And so developers can ingest, store, and analyze all types of time series data. And that covers metrics, events, and traces. And they can do it all in a platform that is designed to handle the high speed and high volume data ingest and real-time analysis. And InfluxDB itself consists of our core database and storage engine, the API, and a surrounding ecosystem of tools and integrations to ingest, query, and analyze that time series data.
Sweet. So why does a purposely built time series platform matter to IoT folks?
Today, pretty much all IoT data is time series data. It's generated by sensors, systems, and applications that change over time and are, you know, therefore time-stamped in some way. And so as companies build new IoT systems and applications, the developers themselves working on those just have to keep up with the data, which is growing exponentially. The sources of data in IoT are everywhere. I mean, it could be sensors on a wind turbine, solar panels on a roof, temperature gauges in smart agriculture fields, or even sensors and gauges in a connected car, like the ones we drive every day. And these sources are producing data, things like temperature and usage and battery life, location, speed, engine efficiency. Now multiply all of that by the time intervals, and that's a lot of data.
What are some of the challenges associated with this amount of data?
First is, you know, pure volume. It's a massive workload of data, exponentially larger than is typical. And second, for a typical database, whether it's relational or document, you know, laboring through so many of these reads and writes really impacts performance. The ingest is slow and the query is even slower. The long-term retention and access becomes really difficult. So if you have tons of very recent or hot data alongside a longer history of older, important, but slightly less relevant cold data, how do you manage both? These are the hard technical challenges that most incumbent DBs are just not able to handle. And so where other DBs and tools fade, InfluxDB really shines. Solving these time series challenges is why InfluxDB exists.
So can you tell me a little bit about how your customers are using InfluxDB?
Yes. So let's look at an example. Let's start with Tesla. Tesla is a leader in smart home energy. Their home power walls pull time series data from the unit that's mounted in each user's home. And that's emitting things like power level, usage, and some other metrics all throughout the day, taken at regular intervals. And they use InfluxDB to collect and analyze this time series data.
All right. And where can our listeners go to find out more about InfluxDB?
The best thing to do is to try the product, and you can do that by going to our website at influxdata.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Chuck Sabin, who is Senior Director of Market Development at the Bluetooth Special Interest Group. Hello, Chuck. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Stacey.
I am really excited. Bluetooth has been a big part of my life. Normally, I would say I would be listening to you on my Bluetooth headphones, but today is a special day and I've lost them because they're so small and convenient. So we are all super familiar with Bluetooth. Bluetooth Low Energy is probably, I'm going to call it like a cornerstone connectivity standard for like IoT and wearables. So I'm sure you would call it something fancier.
Definitely, yeah, Bluetooth Low Energy is definitely a technology that demonstrated to people what the Internet of Things, the IoT, could be by essentially making it such that any device could be a connected device. And I think we've continued to build on that within this organization. And I think that's why you think about low energy and Bluetooth Low Energy technology so much.
There we go. And then y'all introduced Mesh. It got really exciting. We can do cool things with location. So we're here on the show today to talk about two things. One, electronic shelf labels, which is really new and really exciting. And then two, what comes next for Bluetooth? So to kick it off, y'all announced the electronic shelf label initiative. Can you talk to me about what that is and why y'all are doing it?
Certainly. You know, as you may know, electronic shelf labels are essentially the label at the shelf edge, right? And what we introduced was standardization of the electronic version of those labels on a retail shelf. And this is something that's being driven by sort of big box retailers or driving the need for overall standardization of these electronic shelf labels because they ultimately want to get more efficiencies, right? They want to get automated pricing. They want to optimize their in-store operations, and they overall want to improve the overall customer satisfaction. And so Bluetooth as a technology is the technology that they're choosing to make that standardization happen.
All right. So what exactly are we standardizing? Are we standardizing the gateway to the tag, that radio connection? Are we doing a software layer over it to dictate certain things? What is actually happening?
Yeah, that's a fair question. So standardization from Bluetooth in this case comes in the form of a new enabling feature called periodic advertising with response. And I know that's a mouthful, but you know, effectively that's it's a low data capability that provides the capability for a single Bluetooth anchor point in the ceiling, let's say at a retail location, to efficiently communicate with and receive responses from the thousands of ESL tags that are at a location. And this was adopted earlier this year, and there's also additional profiles and services that are ready for adoption in the next few weeks that ultimately standardize the communication format between that label and that anchor point.
Let's start with the underlying standard here. So periodic advertisements with response. Now, advertising is not new for Bluetooth.
Correct.
I think it was at 5.0, 5.1, maybe even earlier, where we had advertising, and that was around locations. And it was basically my Bluetooth device saying, "Hi, I'm here."
Yes.
Yes.
And that's it. The advertising's been part of the Bluetooth low energy specification since its inception. What it is an advertisement from one device to another, letting it know what, you know, to do something or to wake up or to do whatever. It is it's a concept for communicating information that is usually one way. I'm advertising to you, I'm here. Here's information, and it's just advertising one way. The capability that's being built into the specification is more about using that concept, but then getting a response from the other device to let you know that it has received the advertisement and that it has acknowledged that it has the information that it needs. So when you're talking about these types of things for ESL and for shelf labels, you want to make sure once you've advertised out that you're getting a response back from that device that, yes, I've received that, for verification and validation that the information has been received by that device. And that's really the core element of where that standardization of using that advertising channel is coming from.
Got it. And now you mentioned there being profiles and services on top of that. What are some of those services and profiles that you're going to layer on top of the ESL standard?
They effectively are the definition of what is a Bluetooth electronic shelf label. So when you define and sell and market a Bluetooth electronic shelf label, they're all defined in the same way. They use the same data format. They use the same language. They use the same abilities and capabilities of how to connect and how to communicate. That's what the profile and services ultimately define for manufacturers who are building products that are associated with this specification.
And just to get people maybe excited about this, I can't tell. The market for electronic shelf labels is huge. If I imagine every grocery store, every bodega, every whatever, that's astonishing to me. Can you talk about where you expect to see these first? Is this like a grocery store thing? Is this inventory inside warehouses? I don't know. Where will we see these first? And then how is this going to change the shopping experience?
The market for electronic shelf labels is one, when you think about it as a total addressable market, is in the billions, right? It is in anything and everything that you may want to label and or communicate something back to the consumer in a consumer experience. It can also be done in industrial and manufacturing as well, for labels for manufacturing and picking parts, picking systems for manufacturing. But the primary and the initial implementations you're going to see are in retail. Whether or not it's grocery retail or general big box retail, where they're looking to gain basic benefits around this, right? I mentioned these earlier. One is around automated pricing, right? This is where you provide more efficient and dynamic pricing that will help either drive demand, or it can also increase compliance with regulations for accurate pricing. There are regulations out there, especially in Europe, where you're trying to make sure that the price that's on the shelf is the exact same price that's at the register when you go to check out. And so doing electronic shelf labeling provides an assurance that type of compliance and consistency exists within your store and within your organization. They're also looking to optimize their overall in-store operations. This could be more efficient staffing with less, you know, reliance on manual work. It can be for more efficient stock pickers for online shopping and customer fulfillment, where you actually are flashing an LED on the electronic shelf label. And it also provides opportunities for connections to sensors, where you might be looking for inventory, management or expiration of product that's on shelf, and you need to communicate that information back to the back to the central system and to the stockers of the components or the inventory in retail.
That last one's a little confusing. So the idea is that the system will know somehow that the milk is expired, and it will flash something to tell an employee that the milk is expired. Like, or are we talking about a sensor integration? Help me understand.
You could do it in a number of different ways. One might be using that stock, the people who are picking stock for online shopping as an example. You may be going down the aisle and you're notifying, there's a notification that goes down to the electronic shelf label that you're picking, you know, this item, and that item. And there's a flashing LED that's on the label that allows you to just efficiently walk down the aisle, pick the items that you need without even having to think about it, picking the items you need and putting them into your baskets as well. In that same vein, there is opportunity where if stock is low and you need to restock something and you have people that are basically restocking the shelves, you can actually have different items flashing at various times to indicate where and when the person actually needs to actually restock that information. And you can carry that scenario and that use case down to a number of different things. You know, if certain things have expiration dates associated with them, and you're basically just identifying the items where expiration may be a challenge, and the people who are managing inventory go in and manage that within the label, or the label is indicating which items are needing additional inventory, additional maintenance.
Okay, so in that case, in that kind of expiration example, it is literally just this add-on feature. And that was where I was getting confused. I was like, well, the system already knows. It should tell someone, but this is we've told them, and now this will make it easier for them to find. Okay.
Exactly. Essentially, that's around optimizing your in-store operations, right? Just making it very simple for people to achieve the results of the job that they're supposed to be.
And I'm sure one day it'll blink it out to robots, and it won't even need to be a visual light. It'll just be a little Bluetooth signal to a robot, and it'll come through and it'll be like, boom, gone. And then you were going to tell me another possible use case, it sounded like.
Yeah, just in terms of when the retailers are looking to implement electronic shelf labels, the other areas around just overall improved customer satisfaction. And some of the areas that we've heard about this area is around many retail stores. Obviously, they think in terms of omni-channel, right? They've got their in-store brick and mortar. They've got online business. There's always been this challenge as to whether or not what you see in your brick and mortar actually matches, especially from a pricing perspective, matches what maybe the online team is doing. Now what you have is this ability to essentially contain that information into a central system, and that central system can now be updating the in-store pricing to be consistent with what the online pricing is, as an example. So from a customer satisfaction perspective, you know you're getting the best price possible from this particular location.
Got it. Okay. And let's talk about beyond ESL. The Bluetooth SIG has a lot of things going on, especially related to IoT. What else are y'all looking at and thinking about?
If I was thinking about it from an IoT perspective, there's a couple of other experiences and enhancements that we've got coming forward. One is around enhancing Bluetooth wireless for wireless network lighting control and new standardization for Bluetooth network lighting control. And then the second area is around our messaging and direction around the ambient IoT, which I'm pretty sure you've had a significant amount of experience in, or at least discussion about what is this ambient IoT, what is it trying to provide. You know, I look at it as ambient IoT is pervasive IoT connectivity for almost anything. Right. This is the IoT that's going to be enabled by these, you know, very low cost, printable, battery free, energy harvesting Bluetooth tags that can go on almost any product. It can go on almost any device. It can go on almost any item that you're wishing to track or understand its condition or understand its state or understand its location. That area of ambient IoT really provides the overall real-time visibility to track location, condition, state of almost anything. And that's where this larger market of the IoT, this larger vision of the IoT may really start to come to pass.
Yeah. So what needs to be standardized around these, I'll just call them self-powered Bluetooth tags? Do we need a radio level protocol? Do we need profiles? Like where does the SIG need to step in here?
Yeah, I think this is where a standardized data format associated with ambient IoT may make sense, right? Where you're trying to understand what are the key items that I want to understand from this particular item. I want to understand its location, its condition, its state, right? So when you're getting information back from these tags, do you understand what that information consistently is and understand how to process that information from that tag itself? So that's where some of the standardization, I think, needs to take place inside the ambient IoT side of it.
And that's a working group right now?
Essentially, we have a number of member companies that are defining different tags and what those battery-free type of tags are. They're using standard Bluetooth data formats, but right now, mostly using their own sort of proprietary format for what is the data that's actually being received from that. And those are their own standard, you know, their own models and profiles at this point. So I do think that there needs to be a standardized profile for what the ambient IoT is. So understanding, okay, if I receive this data, what is that data about?
Now, would it be so vertically focused, like I am a location tracking tag, I am a temperature tracking tag, or would it just be tags general and you would define all of that as part of the same standard?
Yeah, I don't think you necessarily need to have each tag defined as a particular use case. I think the tags themselves can be generic and general. And I think you can define a data format that is associated with certain types of use cases, whether or not it might be location, condition, or state, as an example. So as tags are communicating that information, they're communicating in a consistent format that allows you to understand, okay, this is a set of state information, and here are the different ways to communicate what state is. And then that information is processed by the backend system in a consistent manner.
Got it. Okay. And wireless network and lighting control. I don't see a lot of Bluetooth lights. And up until like mesh became popular, when I did see them, I hated them. But I feel like they could be useful now. So what are y'all looking at there?
So it's interesting you say that, because Bluetooth, especially in a commercial industry, when you talk about network lighting control, and then you talk about wireless network lighting control, Bluetooth as a technology is actually one of the most predominant technologies in use in wireless network lighting control. Now, this can be anywhere from Bluetooth being used for device provisioning or as a control technology in proprietary solutions, or it could be all the way up to standardized Bluetooth network lighting solutions that include sort of a full stack from radio to networking to device models and profiles. So if you actually look at the commercial lighting industry, Bluetooth is actually a predominant technology across all of the solutions that you'll see out in the market, or a part of the solution in all of those network lighting solutions. Now, that said, there is growing commercial progress in Bluetooth network lighting control. This is where, you know, Bluetooth is the technology across the entire stack for those solutions. And if you look at most major vendors, they all have and are supplying Bluetooth network lighting control solutions. In the thousands of nodes, there's a number of solutions that are highlighted on Bluetooth.com. Now, Bluetooth NLC is actually just getting better. What we're actually doing is standardizing more operational features and introducing additional high-level device profiles to increase opportunity for cross-vendor interoperability. So what you will see in late Q2 is a series of enhancements to the mesh protocol that are specifically targeted towards Bluetooth network lighting control to bring in more efficiency, more functionality to the network lighting control systems, including things like larger object transfers, larger data blobs, essentially, and firmware updates over the network, which will provide better network management for these network lighting solutions.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for joining us this week. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it very much. Thanks a lot.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things cast. Please join us Thursday and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stot.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. And please subscribe.